I didn't make a living as a writer for years. My neighbor, upon hearing I was a Christian author, once said, "Oh, is there a market for that?" Me, I have no idea. Run your race. Maybe you need to invest in your gifts. Take a class, go to a conference, sign up for a seminar, start that small business, put that website up, build in some space, say yes to that thing, work with a mentor. Stop minimizing what you are good at and throw yourself into it with no apologies. Do you know who will do this for you? No one. You are it. Don't bury that talent, because the only thing fear yields is one dormant gift in a shallow grave. How many trot out that tired cliche, "I'm waiting for God to open a door," and he is all, "I love you, but get going, pumpkin," because usually chasing the dream in your heart looks surprisingly like work. Don't just stand there, bust a move. God often sounds like young MC. You are good at something for a reason. God designed you this way on purpose. It isn't fake or a fluke or small. These are the mind and heart and hands and voice you've been given, so use them. Let the rest of us grin at you while you run your race. Let us be proud. Let us be inspired and grateful that God made you to do this thing like a boss. The timing is never right. Forget that. It rarely just falls into your lap. You are probably not guaranteed success. This might be a risk. It will require sacrifices from you and maybe your people. And you might step out on shaky, shaky legs. But off you go. Because we were not created to stand still, even though that is safe and familiar and you are guaranteed never to fall or stumble or grow weary. We were made to run. Run. I'm grinning at you. We all are. Chapter 6, Not Buying. I just saw a commercial for Moose that will not only battle this Texas humidity and make me a hair model, but also make people laugh hysterically at my wit. Who knew I could be that funny? It seems my new hair will attract young, good-looking, multicultural friends, and we will run through a field laughing over our shoulders while our hair bounces and shines. Well done, Moose. I have some tips for advertisers. Locked away in your labs, you forget about regular consumers in the real world, but I'm here to remedy that. We want you to know our brains are actually functional. And furthermore, we have a decent grasp on the English language, including made-up words that aren't actually a thing. Yes, some of us are getting older. I know. Fine. True. You're onto us. However, when you peddle products with invented words like collagen modules and liposome spheres, you give us angry feelings. When you promise your synthesized, skin-identical ceramides will visibly turn back the hands of time on skin damage, did you account for the tanning oil I put on my teenage face and how I refused hats to avoid an irregular tan? Am I to believe you can reverse decades of solar tomfoolery with your ceramides? Stop it. Unless you have a time-traveling DeLorean, these wrinkles and sunspots are here to stay. Another thing, regarding your celebrity endorsers. The day Jennifer Lopez styles her hair with L'Oreal Eversleek and Halle Berry coats her eyelashes with Maybelline will be the day magazines stop casting 22-year-old models in anti-aging ads. The only thing that will help this college student fight the evils of aging more than our expensive cream is her physical and biological youth. This is horse crappery. Advertisers, we know these wealthy, famous women have estheticians and masseuses on their permanent payroll, so they are not fetching their beauty products from Walgreens. We know Sarah Jessica Parker's hair is not Garnier Nutrice Natural Shades No. 60 Light Natural Brown. We would rather you admitted, Eva Mendez doesn't actually use our lip gloss, but we've included a picture of her in our advertisement because she thinks fondly of you while her lips are being injected with the blood pigment of fairy babies. Listen, just talk real to us. We might actually believe it if you said, this product will neither enhance your chakras nor transform your troubled relationships, but it will mostly remove hard water stains in your bathtub. That's the best we can do here. Super. Even better? If you cast a tired-looking mom with dirty hair and torn yoga pants to scrub the tub with an expression that makes sense, rather than a coiffed lady in linen capri pants who smiles at this fascinating experience. I have never in my life been delighted while scrubbing my shower. I hope this gets through to you. Inversely, creators of As Seen on TV products, you can probably tamp down the utter defeat your actors experience during ordinary tasks, like using the remote control with their arms under a blanket, hashtag the struggle is real, or slicing a tomato. These challenges are not incapacitating an entire generation like your market researchers have led you to believe. Chopping vegetables the old way doesn't actually take forever. And I'm not sure eliminating cooking's most frustrating task with the innovative easy egg cracker has gauged the average cook's ability to crack an egg without a nervous breakdown. I'm just saying your ads are high on drama and low on felt needs. Maybe the As Seen on TV people should just market to celebrity endorsers and skip us altogether because they have real troubles. Why? Just recently, Gwyneth lamented the age-old frustration with Parisian concierges. When you go to Paris and your concierge sends you to some restaurant because they get a kickback, it's like, no, where should I really be? Where is the great bar with organic wine? Where do I get a bikini wax in Paris? Bless. Hey, sisters, may I inject some opinions here? Advertising aimed at women is a disaster. On one hand, they bombard us with a not-so-subtle message. You are getting older, and this is the worst thing that has ever happened. According to the beauty industry, with the right purchases, wink, we can reclaim our youth, fix our pathetic baby-bearing bodies, and fool everyone. Forget how the images they offer are absolute works of fiction. They sell caricatures. And even as our minds acknowledge the deception, our hands reach for our wallets. We believe their assessment. You are not beautiful enough, but we can fix it. This same industry believes real life is also too hard for us, but they are here to help. Most notably, the food business. I mean, apparently we cannot possibly cook like every generation before us in history. Advertisers suggest a good breakfast is utterly beyond us. Crack an egg? How could we possibly? We can't manage real food in the morning. Help us, marketing people. Give us something fast. Help us through this difficult conundrum of breakfast with food things you concocted in your labs. Meanwhile, it takes 3 minutes to fry an egg and serve it over toast. We should stop listening to this nonsense. Women have nurtured their families with good, real food since creation. It simply isn't true that cooking is beyond our capacity. To feed the machine, advertisers use buzzwords like quick and easy, no fuss, ready in minutes, heat and serve. But do we even want those qualities around our tables? When did chopping onions and peeling carrots become so abhorrent? Isn't that how women have fed their people all along? With stuff that came from the actual earth? I don't like the picture marketers paint of us. Overly busy moms with no time or energy to feed our families well. I don't appreciate how cooking is portrayed as an unbearable imposition. A hassle better left to professionals. I certainly don't like their options comprised of absolute food fiction. Lean pockets are not actually a healthy alternative. This is crazy. Cooking is not an affliction, and we aren't incapable women who can't crack eggs. We should disregard those commercials and remember that feeding people real food has always been a good, noble task. Nothing unclenches my shoulders more than turning on some Ben Howard music, pouring a glass of Cabernet, and starting dinner. Just drop some onion and garlic in olive oil, and your day improves exponentially. Cooking isn't actually hard at all. It is the simple mechanism that nourished every generation in time. Messages that tell us we aren't pretty enough, young enough, thin enough, or desirable enough are garbage. Anyone who implies we are unable to care for our own families is lying. If you believe the persona that marketing culture has crafted, helpless, too stressed, overwhelmed, incompetent without their products, I am here to say otherwise. You are not a moron or a damsel in distress. You are smart and able, and getting older is not a tragedy. Don't believe them. Even if some observations are descriptive, they need not be prescriptive. You are not a total hot disaster. Well, no more than any of us. You can do hard things. And some hard things are actually easy things, rebranded as impossible. You are more than some company's profitability, and you don't need their tricks to live a beautiful, meaningful life. We can reclaim our merit without dancing like monkeys. But just in case, I have 1 inch of gray hair, lovely readers, so I'm off to color my hair with a box dye, which will have stunning and otherworldly results because Cameron Diaz uses the exact same brand. Not only can you do hard things, but also you can make fancy-sounding French food. I give you an absolute foolproof recipe, adapted from Ina Garten. Beef bourguignon, served 6 to 8. To begin, you'll need 1 tablespoon olive oil, 8 ounces bacon, diced, 2.5 pounds chuck beef, cut into 1-inch cubes, kosher salt, freshly ground black pepper, 1 pound carrots, sliced diagonally into 1-inch chunks, 2 yellow onions, sliced, 2 teaspoons chopped garlic, 1 bottle of dry red wine, like a Pinot Noir, 1 can or 2 cups of beef broth, 1 tablespoon tomato paste, 1 teaspoon fresh thyme leaves, or 1/2 teaspoon dried, 4 tablespoons unsalted butter at room temperature, 3 tablespoons all-purpose flour, 1 pound fresh mushrooms, thickly sliced, and for serving, you'll need country bread or sourdough, toasted or grilled and rubbed with garlic clove, and 1/2 cup chopped fresh parsley. First of all, don't panic at the ingredient list. Look at it. Butter and flour and such. You have almost all of this. Don't let the fancy name fool you. This is basically stew. A one-pot meal, sisters. So get your Dutch oven because you are about to make magic. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Heat olive oil in a Dutch oven. Add bacon, and cook over medium about 10 minutes, stirring a bit until it is brown. Remove with a slotted spoon to a large plate, but leave that bacon grease in the pot for the love of deliciousness. Dry the beef cubes with a paper towel and give them a hefty douse of salt and pepper. In single layer batches, sear the beef cubes on all 4 sides in the hot oil/bacon grease, about 3 to 5 minutes. Remove the cubes to the plate with the bacon and keep this up until all of the beef is browned. Don't skip this step. Sure, it adds a few minutes to the recipe, but it will turn that cheap cut of meat into a superstar later. Stop rushing. What else do you need to do? Go cure cancer? Into all that good juice and drippings, toss in the carrots, onions, 1 tablespoon of salt, and 2 teaspoons of pepper. Cook for 10 to 15 minutes, stirring occasionally. Add the garlic and cook for another minute. At this point, the aroma gets ridiculous. Put the meat and bacon back in the pot. Add the bottle of wine. You read that right. The entire bottle, you lushes. Plus enough beef broth to cover the meat. Add the tomato paste and thyme. Bring to a simmer. Cover the pot with a lid and slide in the oven for about 2 hours until the meat and vegetables are fork tender. Pray someone knocks on your door to witness how good your house smells. Back on the stovetop, combine 2 tablespoons of butter and the flour with a fork. Stir the product into the stew. This will thicken it and add creaminess. Saute the mushrooms in 2 more tablespoons of butter until lightly browned and add to the stew. Bring to a boil, then lower the heat and simmer for 15 minutes. Season to taste. To serve, toast thick slices of bread, then rub them with a cut clove of garlic. The garlic melts into the hot bread like magic. For each serving, spoon the stew over a slice of bread and sprinkle with parsley. You could also serve over mashed potatoes or egg noodles or just nothing because it is so delectable. But whatever you do, dunk some bread in it. Serve in shallow bowls with a rich, spicy Cabernet and a fire in the fireplace. This is such a crowd pleaser, you have no idea. You cannot mess this up. If this is for company, make it the day before and heat to serve, because the first day of this recipe is divine. But on its second day, you hear angels sing and see the face of the Lord. Chapter 7. Tell the Truth. A few weeks ago, I was on a plane. Specifically, I was fretting on a plane. Our little HGTV show was premiering soon, and I was having an internal crisis for a myriad of reasons. Our family will be exposed on a whole nother level. Should we have accepted this remodel? Will my readers find it excessive? Did we represent God well? Will this make me the next media target? Is it okay to live in such a cute house after writing 7? Did we make the right choice? How are people going to react to this? My brain had some ideas. It suggested acting assured and self-confident when talking about the show publicly. My brain told me to craft careful messaging and hold my cards close. Be easy breezy, it said. Don't let anyone know you are conflicted for Pete's sake. Do not provide ammunition for the internet to use against you. There is no room here for personal struggle. If you are having a branding crisis, zip it. It's too late for this nonsense. I stared out the window, writing press releases in my head to shape this correctly, when a clear and immediate thought slammed into my brain. Just tell the truth. It was so right and simple. Tears drained down my face. Just tell the truth, Jen. If you are conflicted and worry a renovation might muddy the message of 7, just say it. If you are afraid people will be disappointed in the show, admit that. If you're scared new people won't like you and might be mean, fess up. If you are mostly sure you made the right decision but have some doubts, concede it. It's okay to have human feelings, even if a whole big bunch of people are watching you have them. I'm not prone to exaggeration. I am exactly prone to exaggeration. But before that flight landed, it had become my new mantra for life. Just tell the truth. Whatever question comes, just tell the truth. If you don't know the answer, admit you struggle. If you disagree with the conversation, don't sit there acting otherwise. Stop trying to self-preserve. That is a fool's errand. Sisters, can you imagine a world where we could be free enough to tell the truth? Letting hard things be hard and confusing things be confusing? If we fought the instinct to prop things up, to polish and tilt and arrange the pieces in just the right lighting, we would be free. We could all exhale. The best I offer the world is the truth, my highest gift. What the world does with it is not up to me. I am not in charge of outcomes, opinions, assessments. I am not in the business of damage control. When I present a fabricated version of myself, the self who knows all, is ever certain, always steps strong, we all lose. Because I cannot keep up with that lie, and neither can you. Here's the truth. Sometimes life is complicated. Do you know how often I make decisions that seem mostly right, but then a few weird slivers remain and I move anyway? Do you know how much theology I have to leave in the I just won't understand this until I meet him face to face drawer? I deeply want to live well, but constantly worry some of my categories are in full disarray. Sometimes I'm not sure. Sometimes I'm conflicted. Sometimes I change my mind. Sometimes I'm way more human than folks are comfortable with. We all are. That's the irony of it. Why do we think others live carefree, self-assured lives while we slink around in the messy middle? Doubt is universal. Read the Bible. Life is plagued with regret, confusion, uncertainty, and colossal failures. Scratch just beneath the surface, and you'll find humanity in all of us. If we could believe we are deeply connected in the fragile places, we could drop the games. When you tell me the truth about yourself, I no longer hide from you. You become safe for me. So guess what? You are now a recipient of my truth too. I'm drawn to you. Your vulnerability makes a path for my own. Your truth-telling says to me, I will not despise, judge, or abandon you. Ironically, it gives me the courage to be afraid, the strength to be weak. What keeps you from telling the truth? I'm guessing shame and fear, those two devils. The doggone irony is how they often prey upon an imagined reaction. People might get mad. They might be ugly. They might talk bad about me. They might not understand. We invent a worst case scenario and it mutes us. The truth is, most people respect vulnerability and hold it with tender hands, especially those who love us and faithfully bear our stories. We are so afraid, but truth telling leads to life. Like Brené Brown said in Daring Greatly, put this book down immediately and buy hers. Daring Greatly is not about winning or losing. It's about courage. In a world where scarcity and shame dominate and feeling afraid has become second nature, vulnerability is subversive, uncomfortable. It's even a little dangerous at times, but nothing is as uncomfortable, dangerous, and hurtful as believing that I'm standing on the outside of my life looking in and wondering what it would be like if I had the courage to show up and let myself be seen. And even if someone is nasty, recognize the safe people who guard your story. They deserve to be in your stable and be trusted with your truth. As for the others, as Scott Stratton, author of Unmarketing, says, don't try to win over the haters. You're not the jackass whisperer. I will now abuse this phrase with reckless abandon. That brings us to the other side, dear ones, receiving someone else's truth. Has it ever been scarier to risk vulnerability? The internet is terrifying. Christians, specifically, can be petrifying. I've watched good people put truthful, hard words out there and get slaughtered. Every time that happens, people retreat more, because who wants that sort of humiliation? Brown has more to say. We judge people in areas where we're vulnerable to shame, especially picking folks who are doing worse than we're doing. If I feel good about my parenting, I have no interest in judging other people's choices. If I feel good about my body, I don't go around making fun of other people's weight or appearance. We're hard on each other because we're using each other as a launching pad out of our own perceived shaming deficiency. May I suggest a starting place as truth receivers? It is okay for someone else to struggle. Furthermore, it is okay to not fix it, solve it, answer it, discredit it. Another believer can experience tension. Say something true that makes people uncomfortable, and God will not fall off his throne. It is not our responsibility to fix every mess. If someone steps onto the scary ledge of truth, it is enough to acknowledge her courage and make this promise. I am here with you as your friend, not your savior. We are not good gods over one another. We are better humans beside each other. Simply speaking truth out loud is healing in and of itself. When people courageously voice a true hard thing, they've already stolen some of its dark power before we offer one word to fix it. Theology backs that up. Of our own Jesus, Scripture says, in him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John 1, 4 and 5. Light and life are greater than the darkness. Pulling something difficult from its dark hiding place and into the light is innately healing. When we bear witness to this bravery, we should simply receive it gratefully, knowing the heavy lifting is already done. It's good to remember in community, and even better to practice individually, that light trumps darkness. If you're concealing a dark struggle, you guarantee its power if it's shrouded in secrecy. Buried, it's free to hinder you, grow in your imagination, and truncate your future. It can hold you back, destroy relationships, and break your spirit. It can absolutely wreak havoc on your authenticity, as the inside contradicts the outside day after day, month after month. Secrets are wild and free in the dark. But when you drag that truth kicking and screaming into the glorious light, you can see it for what it is. It wasn't as menacing as it pretended. It isn't as uncommon as it claimed. It's actually sad and pathetic sitting there in the light, shriveling up and losing power over you. You said it out loud and no one dropped dead. So what can it still hold over you? Then your good people blast their light on it, shining truth and love and compassion and understanding, and it withers even more. With every, I am here, and I've been there, and you aren't alone, and God has this, your scary truth gets less terrifying, less overwhelming, less paralyzing. It becomes fully exposed, with no secrets left to threaten you. You are 2 Corinthians 4, because although this darkness pressed you so hard, it did not crush you. Perhaps it struck you down, but look at you. You're not destroyed. You see that in the light. You are still standing. If you are still breathing, there is still hope. Then what a rescue. Jesus shines his light onto your dark truth, and you are saved. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. 2 Corinthians 4:6. In the Rolodex of privileges as one of God's own, certainly our status as overcomers is one of the highest. Because greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. This isn't just pretty poetry. It is the gospel truth. The darkness has not overcome the light, and the light is ours. Just tell the truth because it sets us free. This first domino unleashes a chain reaction of liberation. If we tell the truth in small things, our honesty is well practiced when stuff gets dire. This creates a sincere community for which the earth is starving. In a world full of the fake, artificial, pretend, and superficial, we have the sustenance to nourish our starving hearts. I promise to be gentle with your truth-telling. And you've already demonstrated tenderness with mine. And as we witness this beautiful community, we aren't just observing vulnerability, but rather chains breaking, darkness receding, victory rising. We are watching the light win, truth by truth. And when enough bright places are created, the dark has nowhere else to hide. Show up, be seen. Tell the truth, be free. Chapter 8, Thank You Notes, Part 1. Jimmy Fallon is the best thing to happen to late night television since Netflix. He is shamelessly awkward, and if I could, I would cut a lock of his hair. My favorite segment is Thank You Notes, in which he expresses sarcastic gratitude to various and sundry things. If imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, this is probably closer to outright plagiarism. I offer the following thank you notes scattered throughout this book, like comic relief segments, written with help from my hilarious Facebook friends. Thank you, Spanx. Because of you, my post-baby body can mold like Jell-O into a svelte, sexy little shape, for a few hours anyway. Your ability to lift and tuck simply takes my breath away, literally. May you continue to do God's work and be the progenitor of the muffin top. Thank you, Sarah Blakely. Sincerely, all women. Thank you, Daylight Savings Time, for making people wax on about the wonder of an extra hour of sleep, only to serve as an especially depressing reminder to parents that kids don't care about farmers and harvests and extra hours of daylight. I enjoy my kids standing at my bedside at 4:30 a.m. like creepy, wide-awake children of the corn. Nap times are also jacked, so there's that. With all due respect-ish, a tired mom. Thank you, obvious warning labels. Without you, I might have stuck my kid in a washing machine, lit a match near an open gas line, used my hair dryer while sleeping, or, God forbid, not realized eggs may contain, wait for it, eggs. I have no idea how I ever function without you. I almost ingested the contents of a lava lamp just yesterday, but your label made another quick save. God bless. Thank you, Instagram filters, for you have helped me put out many works of photographic fiction that make me appear younger, tanner and thinner than I actually am. Natural lighting may be my nemesis, but lo-fi is my BFF, Lilas. Thank you, Daylight and Rearview Mirror, for bringing to light the long, wiry chin hairs I missed during my morning tweeze session. You also exposed my eyebrows as an absolute tragedy. I have enough undetected facial hair to qualify me as a Sasquatch, so thanks for the heads up. Sorry, car next to me at the stoplight, there is no other way. Thank you, retail stores, for putting Christmas decorations out in October. It is not even Halloween, and my children have morphed into unbridled capitalists. Now every commercial is an excuse for my children to scream, "I want that for Christmas!" for 3 months. What a delight. Sincerely, mom trying to teach her children about baby Jesus, but struggling to compete with a Disney-themed slanket. Thank you, Amazon Prime, first, for existing. Secondly, for allowing me to make free shipping the justification for buying all the books and only seeing how much I saved. Thirdly, for allowing me to purchase boys' underwear, fish sauce, toilet paper, and folders with Brad's without leaving my couch. And for shipping these items to me in 4 different boxes, none properly sized for the item it contains. You've made this lazy anti-shopper so happy. Be my boyfriend, AP. Thank you, Maxi Dresses, for helping me appear dressed up, as though I really made an effort, but making me feel as if I'm wearing a nightgown out in public. You are basically crotchless yoga pants, and I salute you. Thank you, Period Calendar app, for warnings to tread lightly around affected wife for 3 days a month. You've also helped him learn not to say, "Could this be your period talking?" because that is his one-way ticket to see the face of crazy. Sincerely, wife of a husband. Thank you, 4-year-old, for keeping my vanity in check with constant reminders about my fat tummy and old skin. These tragic conditions are your doing, but I appreciate your keen powers of observation. I can't be walking around acting like Giselle when I have important things to attend to, like cooking a meal for you to hate. Sincerely, your old fat mom. Thank you, Netflix, for the 15 seconds between episodes to decide if I'm going to do anything with my life today. The answer is inevitably no, but nobody can say you didn't give me the option. Thank you, 4 p.m., for being the time of day that thoroughly confuses me, post-homework and pre-dinner. I'm already exhausted and fairly irritable. The children are losing their ever-loving minds, and husband is still tucked away in his sane office with all mental faculties intact and won't answer my SOS texts to hurry and come home or their blood is on your hands. Do I make a coffee or pour a glass of wine? Yours, Witching Hour Survivor. Thank you, coffee, for everything. You make life possible. I don't want to make you feel weird, but you are my soulmate. Well done. Thank you, Jim Childcare, for giving me the opportunity to watch TV, take a shower by myself, and drink a smoothie while reading a magazine. Oh, and work out too, but let's be honest, that's not the main reason I'm there. And did I once check in my offspring, then scoot next door for sushi? Just let it go. You don't know my life. Thank you, Miss, could you bring me these pants in a size 2? For finding the dressing room adjacent to mine, no matter when or where I try on clothes. You keep me humble. I also appreciate hearing how my size shirt swallows you. And yes, we all know how cold you are in here without any natural insulation. Eat a sandwich. All these people who live in your house. Chapter 9. Hope for Spicy Families. Although it's reductive, I categorize most families as either sweet or spicy. There are pros and cons to both, with tons of overlap on the Venn diagram, but still. In general, a family trends toward one or the other. One guess which way the hat makers lean. We are spicy people. We love obnoxious humor and sarcasm and are very, very loud. The lot of us suffers from enormous feelings, which makes us a passionate, emotional bunch. Our permanent default setting is exclamation marks. We don't really do gentle. We don't actually know what that means. So anytime I'm around a sweet family, I have a crisis. It simmers until a comment from one of their children to another. Sister, would you like the last brownie? You take it since you did all my chores as a surprise for my half birthday. Launches a watershed moment. Brandon knows this about me and has weathered the reentry numerous times. Me. What is wrong with us? We need a new system for people to talk nicer in this house. We are raising feral children. Why don't any of our kids knit? We need to quit raising our voices for the rest of our lives, or we are doomed. Our kids are probably going to kill people one day. They are on dark paths to incarceration or street violence. Brandon, street violence here in the suburbs? Me, there could be violence in these streets. We're near the end times. We need to figure out how to be more adorable. Our kids don't even know any hymns. How will we break out in spontaneous family worship? WWAVD, what would Ann Voskamp do? Let's just throw on the towel. Nothing makes me diagnose my family as catastrophic quicker than another family behaving. A terrible comparison game that isn't even fair, as I'm not privy to their atmosphere beyond that 1 hour. Maybe that darling brownie-deferring sister gave the other a roundhouse kick to the temple the next day for calling her a turd burger. We don't know these things. And it's easy to reduce another family to a prototype to compare against our undomesticated family. The result is despair, then certainty that our children are ruined. Is there any worry like parent worry? We're responsible for whole human lives here. This is it. This is their one childhood leading to one adulthood. They absorb all the hours in this home, emulating what they've seen. God help us. Every mother I know worries she isn't doing this right, failing in countless ways, seen and unseen. Our family faults seem so egregious, omissions and breakdowns and missteps that constitute a complete and total disaster. I heard recently, if you're worried about being a bad parent, you're probably a good one. I wanted to believe this so badly. Am I? Am I a good mom? Because I mostly feel like I'm spitting into the wind here. Then something happened. I jumped outside my mind where the crazy lives and watched myself talking to my kids. I was so nice sometimes. I said sweet and precious things here and there. There were so many I love yous and you are very smarts and attentive mm-hmms and sounds awesomes and great job on that's lace through. I watched myself be a good parent and realized I am my own worst critic and sometimes even a liar. Convincing myself that nothing good is happening and it's all my fault, or maybe Brandon's fault, and the kids are horrid and we are a disaster. I should ignore myself more often. Why do we exaggerate our failures and ignore our successes? I would never overvalue another mother's lows and neglect her triumphs. So why would I do that to myself? Why do any of us? We observe other parents' strengths with 20/20 vision, while our strengths are blurred. I declare your goodness as easily as I affirm my wretchedness. They are inversely proportional. I am conditioned to minimize your humanity and overemphasize mine. Whether you are a sweet mama imagining how the spicy mamas have all the fun, not true, we're mostly breaking up fights, or a spicy mama assuming the sweet mamas have all the tenderness, they don't. They are mostly... I'm not actually sure. I've never been in the sweet family. If you are worried about being a bad parent, you are probably a good one. Some of the good is obvious. The stuff we readily notice in others, the loving words, the endless attention, the eye contact, the praise. We read to our kids and tuck them in with kisses and use affirming parenting language and attend all the games, recitals, tournaments, programs. We braid hair and tie ribbons and apply band-aids and pretend our kids' art is pretty. We do all that, and it's good, and it counts. Some of the good is less obvious, the stuff that also happens in every home. The apologies, the conflict resolution, the tough love, the boundaries, the making up, the hard lessons. We are molding failure into character, both our kids and ours. Every parent blows it. Every kid comes unhinged. Every family goes off the rails. That doesn't mean we're ruined. It means we're ordinary. Course correction is standard. These moments often feel bad because they started bad, but they're actually good, and they count too. This is my point. You are doing a better job than you think. Self-criticism sometimes improves best practices, but it can also lie to you, and probably has. You may need to ignore your mind and watch yourself a while. Not just detecting the sharp moments, but the soft ones, for I assure you they are there. If you would tell a friend having a bad mom day, it's okay. Your kids know you love them. Everyone loses it sometimes. Parenting is hard. Tomorrow is a new day. Then you should extend that same compassion to yourself. Listen, motherhood is not knitting while singing hymns all the time. If that's our standard and every deviation produces a guilt trip, we are doomed. Not every moment is big ticket. Not every conversation with kids is esteem building. Sometimes they just need to get in the bathtub and stop stalling. There's no shame in that. Motherhood has many slivers. Sure, sometimes we intentionally parent, quotation marks in honor of my mom, who says she and her friends just raised us, but people of my generation parent. But we also manage, discipline, intervene, boss around, implement, and even just survive sometimes. We wear many hats, and they don't all include the precious feels. We don't live in an after-school special. We're running households here. Condemnation is a trick of the enemy, not the language of the heavens. Shame is not God's tool. So if we're slaves to it, we're way off the beaten path. And it is harsh out there, debilitating actually. If your inner monologue is critical, endlessly degrading, it's time to move back to grace. Then we can breathe and assess our own parenting with the same kindness we extend to others. Only our overly critical, overly involved generation could engineer such carefully curated childhood environments and still declare ourselves failures. We are loving, capable mothers reading the room all wrong. Can I tell you my goal for my kids? That their childhood is mostly good. People, I declare mostly good a raging success. If I am mostly patient and they are mostly obedient, great. If we are mostly nurturing and they turn out mostly well-adjusted, super. Every childhood needs a portion of lame, boring, aggravating, and tedious. Good grief, life is not a Nickelodeon set. They need something to gripe about one day. Mostly good is later remembered as loved and safe. I now label my childhood magical. Though mom slapped me across the face when I was in 7th grade and never bought me Guess jeans and accidentally left me at church several times. Mostly good is enough. Mostly good produces healthy kids who know they are valued and either forget the other parts or turn them into funny stories. You are doing a wonderful job. Parenting is mind-numbingly hard and no one is perfect at it and we'll all jack 1,000 parts. Yet somehow, against all odds, it will be enough. And if stepping outside your mind to self-observe or planting your feet on a grace highway doesn't work, come to my house for one afternoon and be guaranteed to feel better about your family. As you may recall how I told my then 5th grader, after sassing off, to get a shovel, go in the backyard, and dig his own grave. Because that is what Jen Hatmaker would do. Chapter 10, Surviving School. I recently completed the marathon called Getting 5 Children Ready for Back to School, and now I need therapy. I spent around $400 million, drove to 12 stores, and almost became a serial killer over folders with Brad's. The kids have gym shoes, regular shoes, new clothes, new backpacks, lunchboxes, and school supplies out the yin-yang. We've been to back-to-school night, orientation, schedule pickup, and freshman camp. I filled out personality inventories, insurance documents, volunteer forms, registration packets, and parent contracts. We've had haircuts, vaccinations, eye exams, pep talks, bike tune-ups, and meltdowns. The refrigerator was stocked. The pantry was filled. The lunch accounts were updated. The lectures were given. On the first day of school, the kids were photographed at home and with teachers because humiliation is an important part of childhood. It will take an entire calendar year to recover so I can do it again. I was born in 1974, gentle reader. May I tell you what I remember of back to school? Let's see. one new pair of corduroys, a homemade bangs trim, disastrous, and some hand-me-downs from our babysitter. We rode the bus on the first day of school, and I don't remember how we found our class, because not one mother was on the campus. They were already at jazzercise. We brought one notebook, a pencil, and a bologna sandwich in last year's lunchbox. The end. Furthermore, do you know how often my mom volunteered in my classroom? 0 times. I cannot remember any mother ever at my school. My mom did not have parent homework, and our science fair projects looked like garbage because we did them ourselves as sloppy prepubescent students whose parents weren't about to interrupt dynasty to determine what kind of soil is best for plant growth. There were no parent-led school carnivals, book fairs, or fall festivals because our parents worked and ain't nobody had time for a sand art booth. It was a totally different time. The parents and teachers were in charge, and children were not the little rulers. If my teacher called because I was acting like a lunatic, my parents believed her. I know, right? And made sure I would think twice before opening my smart mouth again. Sidebar. Teachers, I wish parents understood that their precious child probably isn't an innocent victim of your daddy issues and rage disorder. And mom, your daughter got detention for an actual reason. Caitlin Grace needs to do her homework and stop sassing. Her tears are manufactured. Caitlin Grace should join theater. Back in the day, the world did not revolve around us, and when we blew it in school, we paid the piper. Teachers were not expected to sprinkle all the precious snowflakes with magical fairy dust every day, and parents were not expected to repeat all their years of schooling with a daily homework avalanche. I have been in third grade 6 times, and I am D-O-N-E. Getting children through school is now like completing a doctoral program. I absolutely understand why moms claim less work as a reason to homeschool. I have no idea how parents with traditional jobs manage it. How do teachers who are also parents do it? I work from home with a flexible schedule, but if I got home at 6 p.m. and still faced homework, never mind the whole dinner, quality time, and bedtime routine, I would be rocking in a corner in the fetal position. In my opinion, we need to ratchet it down. Moms, I can barely speak of what Pinterest has done to us here. Between bento boxes with sandwiches cut into the shape of dolphins leaping into a sea of kale, and spraying our kids' feet with lemon essential oils to soothe their troubles, I just can't even. I gave my kids those child-centered homemade learning manipulatives instead of Game Boys, but heck if they begin to spot their own errors, self-assess, and complete tasks on their own, and instigate spontaneous math lessons. Dr. Montessori wouldn't last 4 minutes with my kids. Maybe we are entirely too precious, raising tiny narcissists who cannot function without their feet sprayed and chakras rearranged. Everything is so earnest that sometimes I think I will just die. Is it possible to bend the universe too sharply toward our kids? I think yes. Any child who expects every authority figure and system to be geared toward his happiness is in for a shock. You know what school is for? Learning. You know what else? Sometimes kids get a mean teacher, or a class they don't like, or an inflexible deadline, even though that child was exhausted the night before. We should not cushion every blow. This is life. Learning to deal with struggle and to develop responsibility is crucial. A good parent prepares the child for the path, not the path for the child. We can still demonstrate gentle and attached parenting without raising children who melt on a warm day. How can teachers teach when parents demand exceptions and cry foul every time their kid gets crossways? Sometimes we step in and advocate, but sometimes our kids are lame and need to own up. Let them feel the sting of detention, a zero, a lost privilege, a timeout. Let failure instruct them. Otherwise, we neuter the teacher's authority and rob our children of responsibility. And teachers, we'd love to just be parents at home. I absolutely acknowledge the unreasonable demands put upon you. I used to be a teacher. But in the few hours a day we have with our children, We don't want to be tutors, homework drill sergeants, project managers, and trauma counselors. We just want to be moms. Our children are in school 7 hours a day, which is enough for a kid. It's almost a full-time job. They should not endure another 2 hours of homework, especially assignments that are basically parent homework. Don't get me started. Can't we all simmer down a bit? Let the teachers teach, the parents parent, and the kids do the learning. Our children will be fine, just as we were. They'll figure it out, just as we did. They don't need every advantage skewed their way and every discomfort fluffed with pillows. I bet they don't even need sandwich dolphins. I'm a product of bologna, red Kool-Aid, and home perms, and I turned out okay. Do we shield our children from harm? Of course. Do we intervene against injustice? Naturally. Do we nurture and adore them? Obviously. But we should also let them fail, wobble, persevere, overcome. Let's not engineer our entire lives around their entertainment and manufactured success. If our kids only expect blessings and exemptions, they will be terrible grown-ups. These are not the adults we want to launch, nor are they the snowflakes we want our kids to marry. We cannot be the mothers-in-law for these people, oh my gosh. If grown-ups expect sandwich dolphins from their spouses, bosses, churches, friends, and children, this will all be a disaster. It might be helpful to unpack the root motivations behind our hovering tendencies. I suspect fear is the culprit. Will our kids get left behind? Will they have what everyone else has? Will they come out on top? And by proxy, will we? Will they get hurt? What if they are just average? We doubt the results of health and maturity, the basic tools that have always produced amazing young adults. Hard work, failure, simplicity, gratefulness, restraint, and discipline. We forget that no is an acceptable answer to our kids in a world of the unbridled yes. We very much underestimate their resilience, and I worry we consider success to be a product of the parents' diligence more than the child's. This offers short-term success, but sets them up for long-term failure. A kid prepared to work hard, to pay her dues, to own up to her mistakes, and to value instruction is probably going further than the kid who had every advantage skewed her direction and every blow cushioned. Could we identify the lies fear tells us and do the courageous work of parenting against the grain? So I guess that starts now, right? Kiddies, make your own lunches, do your own laundry, buy your own replacement ID after you left yours on the bus. Write your teacher an apology for doing the worm across her classroom, even though Dad and I laughed our heads off. You want more clothes than we bought? Save your money. Make your own case to the teacher for a higher score. Relinquish your phone for running that mouth. Endure that class. Work for that grade. Try harder next time. Take your licks and learn from them. Put your plate in the dishwasher for the love of Palmolive. Better for them to learn these lessons now, while the consequences are small, than later when they are catastrophic. We are not just raising boys and girls. We are shaping future mamas and daddies and professionals and disciples. It is noble, important work with mega outcomes. We want our future sons and daughters-in-law to thank us, not require marriage counseling for their spouse's codependent mommy issues. Dear Lord, keep my name out of the therapist office. So maybe we lower the bumpers on the bowling lane and see what happens. I bet our kiddos are sturdier than we think. Maybe they don't need every gadget and advantage. Maybe kids grow like all humans do, through struggle, failure, and perseverance. They might have a gear we didn't know about and don't need to be coddled like fragile hothouse plants that can't adapt to new environments. I bet the kids will surprise us. And if it turns into shambles, I will personally send you a lifetime supply of sandwich dolphins. Chapter 11, Dear Kids. It's just a random Tuesday, so today is as good as any to tell you all my dreams for your life. I don't want to wait until your graduation parties or rehearsal dinners or some big moment when important words will get swept away in the hustle. Plus, a bunch of this can't wait until you're grown because it matters right now. Also, you are all asleep, so I'm feeling very tender toward you because you are, number one, safe and snug in your beds, and number two, silent. I love you so, but this family has a lot of words. You're just kids, so you have no concept of how much Dad and I think about you. We just seem like bossy parents, I'm sure. One day you'll understand. When you are moms and dads, you'll see. We would forfeit any of our own dreams to make yours happen. But that's hard for you to grasp. We mostly seem like lame buzzkills right now. You'll go crazy mad for your own kids one day and get it. You span 4th through 12th grades. So this is our last year under one roof, the family years. I cannot believe it. These childhood years are all you know. But Dad and I realize how special they are, how far they reach, how long you'll talk about them. We will remember these family years in similar ways, just from the other side. We know they're fleeting because we've already been through them once at your age. Family years go fast, but they matter for a lifetime. With Gavin departing soon, then the rest of you launching every other year, our days of influence are shrinking. I guess I want to put pen to paper here. Make sure you know exactly what we hope for you and from you. They might not be what you think. Oh, sure, we harped on grades all these years, but the honor roll isn't really our main jam. We have dreams other than raising by-the-book kids. Not that you ever were. Kindness. This pulls right to the front. Dad and I have lived half our lives or so, and we've known every type of person. The ones that shine outstanding in our memories are the kind ones. We so deeply want you to be tender toward people. Empathizing is key to a wholehearted life. I pray for your kindness more than your success, because the latter without the former is